This is a Cato Special Podcast. I'm Caleb Brown. For all the pageantry, the State of the Union is typically just a stew of bluster, schmaltz, and a laundry list of wishful spending. And this one was no different. Responding to elements of last night's State of the Union, the Cato Institute's Neil McCluskey on education and Chris Edwards on spending and taxes. But first, Cato's John Glazer comments on the foreign policy content of the speech. There was an inordinate focus here specifically on North Korea. And Donald Trump had guests who were people who had escaped from North Korea. He talked about the regime, but not a lot there that really indicates that he's willing to talk.
Yeah, well, I think actually his comments on North Korea are sort of like his comments throughout the entire speech. The speech itself was very light on actual policy. What he did was tell a lot of harrowing stories that relied on nationalist themes and deeply emotional connections to specific anecdotes in order to try to drum up Americans' emotions about specific policy issues. So he talked about, you know, brave border guards doing extraordinary things to protect Americans from violent gangs coming over the border. And he told stories about children being killed by MS-13. You know, obviously this is in order to drum up emotions towards a harder line immigration stance. He also told stories, war anecdotes of brave soldiers fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria against the Islamic State, because who could not applaud brave soldiers and heroes in war? And this is to kind of drum up support for our continued and various occupations and military operations throughout the greater Middle East region. And the same with North Korea. So he told this harrowing story of a North Korean refugee. He had crutches. He held them up. I mean, how could you not clap for that? And what it was really supposed to do was drum up disgust and revulsion at the totalitarian state in Pyongyang. But what it didn't do was talk much about what ought to be done to solve the problem on the peninsula, what ought to be done to deal with non-proliferation issues in North Korea. How can we balance carrots and sticks and diplomacy with the latent threat of military force in order to change the status quo in a way that's amenable to U.S. interests? There was very little, nuts and bolts policy discussion. It was really all just emotional stories that relied on nationalist themes to drum up support for Trumpian policies.
What did he talk about with respect to spending on the military? It seemed he was very focused on domestic stuff, boosting spending at the border and infrastructure, but it didn't seem like he was pushing that hard for any specific policy relating to foreign policy.
Yeah, I think that's generally true. With regard to the defense budget, it was made a very muted appearance in this speech compared to other things. But we know that Trump asked for more than the Obama administration had projected would be necessary for fiscal year 2018 for the defense budget. And he's asking for even more than that for 2019, something above in the range of $713 billion for the defense budget in 2019. So he's got a real problem when it comes to defense caps that will trigger sequestration, and he hasn't figured out a way to deal with that, and it certainly didn't come out in the speech.
Specifically on North Korea, he says, "We are waging a campaign of maximum pressure to prevent North Korea from getting nuclear weapons."
Right. Yeah, he hopes, I think that him, the president, and members of his administration believe something that's not, to me, very believable. What they believe is that threats and browbeating and maximalist demands on North Korea that Pyongyang finds unacceptable is the only way to yield capitulation and surrender from the adversary. And what they don't understand is that North Korea has built a nuclear weapons program specifically in order to deter the United States because it's afraid of the threats and browbeating and cavalier talk of regime change that we've engaged in for so many years in the past. And if they understand that, if they understand that North Korea has some security concerns of its own that are not unfounded, actually, then only that understanding and a way to kind of make concessions to the other side, maybe offer some security guarantees, maybe offer a promise that we won't impose regime change. These are the kinds of things, you know, stopping military exercises that are deeply provocative with South Korea. These are the kinds of things that might get the North Koreans to budge. But instead, they rely solely on threats and maximalist demands that North Korea finds to be a non-starter. And so that doesn't really get us anywhere, and that's why the North Korean situation hasn't gone anywhere except for alarmingly close to the brink of war.
That's John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Next is Chris Edwards, Director of Tax Policy Studies, discussing the big spending plans for infrastructure and the big tax bill passed late last year. From your perspective, I assume the mind-boggling figure is $1.5 trillion that Donald Trump wants for what he terms infrastructure.
That's right. For a long time, the Trump administration has been promising that they're going to increase infrastructure spending by $1 trillion over 10 years. For some reason, President Trump increased it to $1.5 trillion last night. Although the administration still doesn't have any full details of the plan, about a week ago, a memo leaked out with some of the details. And basically, they want to spend about $200 billion more over 10 years. And in theory, that's supposed to prompt state and local governments to add in the rest for a total of $1.5 trillion. All of this spending goes in the wrong direction. I think we don't need more federal spending for infrastructure. State and local governments can raise their own money anytime they want for their own roads and schools and the like. 98% of U.S. roads and highways, for example, are owned by state and local governments, not the federal government. So, you know, from my perspective, with ownership comes responsibility for the funding. State governments can raise their own gas taxes anytime they want to fund their own roads. We don't need more federal spending.
So he also took credit for a great deal of the job creation that occurred in 2017.
Yeah, he did. I give President Trump a lot of credit for the big corporate tax cut that was signed into law in December. I think that will do great for things for the economy. I'm skeptical whenever any president, claims success for GDP growth that happens on their watch. I think some of the, policy actions presidents take certainly have consequences for the economy sort of over the medium and longer term. I don't know whether short-term fluctuations have that much to do with pronouncements of presidents.
So if you had to give a rating based just upon the issues that you deal with, taxes and spending, what would you say?
Well, again, I think overall the tax plan signed into law in December was a net positive for the economy, a net positive for average people and for American businesses. There was some problems with it. It wasn't how I would design it. I would say also that in the long run, the tax cut passed by Republicans won't last unless Republicans cut spending as well. Deficits are set to explode in coming years because of the massive growth of the big entitlement programs like Medicare. So the tax cuts that Americans will enjoy during 2018 won't last unless they pressure Congress to cut spending. So I think 2018, really optimistically, I hope the Republicans turn their focus to spending restraint and spending cuts. They shouldn't be spending more money on infrastructure. That's a state and local responsibility. So we'll see where Congress takes this.
But not much on spending cuts. But, to his credit, I will say that most State of the Union addresses are $50 billion here, $20 billion there for just a wide variety of programs. He's asking for $1.5 trillion in total for infrastructure spending, which is a lot of money. But over the long haul, how does that compare to the spending wish lists that presidents have issued in the past?
Oh, I think you actually make a good point. I mean, watching his speech, I think it was a good speech for Trump, mainly because he stuck to the teleprompter, rather than flying off the handle as he usually does. And you're right. I think that I haven't done the actual accounting on it, but it is true that most presidents, Republican or Democrat, pepper their speeches with promising all kinds of new programs here and there. There didn't seem to be too much of that with Trump. Again, the infrastructure thing is the wrong way to go on the additional spending. For infrastructure, I mean, Trump is pushing also to deregulate the construction of new infrastructure like highways and the like. So that, he does move in the right direction there. So the deregulation stuff is goes down the right path. The additional spending, that's not the right way to go.
Chris Edwards directs tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. Now Neil McCluskey, director of Cato's Center for Educational Freedom, notes one big positive in last night's State of the Union. The president spent almost no time talking about education.
Yeah, it was actually very refreshing for State of the Union not to have a whole lot of lines about how we're going to, quote-unquote, invest in the children. Because the fact of the matter is the Constitution gives the federal government no authority to involve itself in running schools or funding schools or telling schools what curriculum they're going to use. And the federal government has a really terrible track record in education, both in K-12 education, where for the last 15 years or so, until the most recent law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, but No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, has been just an increasing succession of federal controls. And the country sort of rejected that with Every Student Succeeds Act. And we just don't have any test scores or other outcomes to say the federal government's even done any good in K-12 education. And then in higher ed, I mean, the evidence is very clear that the main thing the federal government does, which is supply student aid, so loans and grants to students, has translated into massive inflation in college costs, massive overconsumption of higher education, huge numbers of people starting and not finishing but being saddled with debt. And so the best thing the federal government can do is just stay out of education. And the only small mention we got of education or schooling was really about vocational training. And in a way, that is sort of a tacit admission by the federal government that they have done nothing but bad stuff, especially in higher ed, basically telling everybody, go to a four-year college. Now we're stepping back and saying, oh, that's probably not the best thing to say, and it's not the best thing for a lot of people. The only thing that would have made the speech better in terms of education was if he had actually said, the federal government is causing more harm than good, and let's get out.
Last year, Betsy DeVos, who's the Secretary of Education, had we heard some rumblings that there might be an attempt to federalize in some way school choice. And I know that concerned you a great deal, but no sign of it here.
Yeah. Also, not totally unexpected, because education also doesn't sort of rise to the top of national priorities at this point. We've got trouble in North Korea with clearly immigration is a major issue. But you would often expect that just as an applause line that the president would say, and let's invest, because the term is always invest, even if there's no evidence we're getting a return on that investment. But they'd say, let's invest in our kids through a national scholarship tax credit or something like that. And the fact they didn't say that, I think, shows really good restraint, or at the very least, it's a good sign that this isn't something they're going to try and push. And it's not that school choice is bad. The huge danger is that you have the federal government become the funder of school choice, and then it's one-stop shopping to regulate and control private schools. And you don't have to look too far back. You just think about the Common Core, which was a federally pushed, coerced national curriculum standard and set of tests to go with it, and we were really close to have the federal government controlling almost everything that public schools teach. We didn't want to give them the power to do the same thing in private schools. So I think it's very encouraging that they didn't mention that possibility at all.
Neil McCluskey directs the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.